But when Makatini Kosin has come to work with us, he came with one type of seed. While previously with Bolisa and OTK, there were a number of varieties of seeds, including the conventional seed. But when this new company came in, the seed itself was very expensive in such a way that the poor farmer cannot afford to buy. Instead of buying it, he has to get a loan, maybe a loan from a member of the household, or sell his livestock for him to start planting.
Manje ngiyabonga kakhulu uma unezalo mbali athi emafama from Makhathini Kotsi bahamba ngama-BMW. Uma ungasuka yotshala emakhathini kothini ohamba nge-BMW loku ungahambi nangebhayisikili.
Very sad to hear the case study by Hans Lombard that the farmers in Makatini are driving the BMW. I'm telling you today, if you go and start farming there with your own BMW, with your own assets, you will come back walking or not even having a bicycle. I feel very sad because we in Makatini, I think we are divided. There are those who are being lobbied by the companies that are providing the PT cotton, and there are those who are very, very poor. In my case, my father had 20 cattle, but today we have got not even have a single cow to milk for our children.
Engakusho futhi kulezi zitshalo ubhothi ukuthi awulimi uyasizakala uyathola ngama-dry land kumbe siwulime singafanga no-fertilizer ke lapho kodwa lapho esikimini akune-irrigation system bese kuthi emakhaya sinema-hectares esiwatshalayo ngaphandle kwemithi nema-chemicals inkinga yakhona sineproblem yokungaphinako komise umhlaba sethu usesikimini usunema-chemicals ngendlala egcwalile. Uma utshale sayenza i-crop rotation, sitshale ukotini, size sitshale ngummbila, senzele ukuthi sishintshe. Kodwa nje hayi, sivune sisabhetha.
We do plant practice household production like bean production and maize. But we found that in Makatini irrigation system itself, where we have practiced a lot of chemical production, GMO operations, hybrid operations, all those highly input cost chemicals, you find that in the second year, even if you do the crop rotation, there's a reduced crop yield.
Just for the record, the locality is in the simple sense, keep the record for regulation. And it's the Swaki director for employment equity.
Why did you say that? Anyway, then welcome to the Mr. Speaker, Mr. Brother, Mr. Speaker. Both of you are not strangers to this committee. But anyway, welcome to all the members, Mr. Watt and Mr. Watt. Just before we get into the meat of this thing, Mr. Chiguni, who was also with us in this committee, is now the mayor of Conway and South Bank. Okay, who wants to start? start up with...
You're lucky I'm not retiring yet, so I don't know if you
Yeah. Well, I've been talking...
Only interesting your time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Same politics in every side. You either drive or you get kicked out.
Kicked out then you retire.
Then you retire. Okay. Now I think we can get into this. This is the speech you lead up.
Thank you, Jesus. And can I just ask that everyone has got one of you? My apologies firstly for the date on this document. You will see it's dated the 21st of May. And it was a result of a misunderstanding of the previous data. I think that a very similar bill was also introduced by Ms. Anson earlier. And I was actually informed that the bill was in the discussed and I prepared this submission on the 21st of May. Realized that was actually the event, or actually the postponement of the meeting of that meeting was even there as the proposal was discussed. If you would allow me the time, I will go through this. It's not in my decision. During 2006, the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Labour conducted public hearing on the issue of youth unemployment. Members of the Freedom Front Plus Youth and an organization known as Six Afrikaanse Studente made a submission in which they argued that the youth unemployment and underemployment is also a phenomenon experienced amongst young youth in general and the Afrikaner youth in particular. In their submission, it was pointed out, amongst others, that according to market research conducted by Stellenbosch Professor Pierre de Tooy, the majority of South Africans favoured the exemption of all youth, young South Africans from the provisions or the limiting aspects of those provisions of affirmative action. Of all groups in our country, the youth is the most affected by joblessness. The International Labour Organization of the United Nations definition of affirmative action is the following: a coherent packet of measures of a temporary character and specifically at correcting the position of members of a target group in one or more aspects of their social life in order to obtain effective equality. Statistics show that the number of black students that entered into tertiary institutions grew by more than 100%, but that the number of white students actually decreased by 20%. Two things can be said from this. The decrease in the number of white youth at tertiary level is indicative that they are at this level being subjected by affirmative action. The representativity measures that universities apply, etc., and that causes a degree of despondency amongst them. In South Africa, 76% of the jobless are younger than 35 years old. On average, it takes 3 years for a graduate to find a gainful employment. Given the fact that great numbers of white school leavers and graduates leave the country due to difficulties finding employment, government should consider the fact that huge amounts of capital invested in education is actually wasted, as we do not succeed in retaining and maintaining the graduates that we are producing. The suggestion was made at the time to address this situation by expanding the definition of the designated group as defined in the Employment Equity Act to also include youths. At the time, one ANC member of the Labour Committee described the suggestion as a milestone proposal.
In response to this, the Labour Committee published its report on the 27th of February 2007, proposing, amongst others, that the committee should examine the issue of the exclusion of youth as a designated group, as reflected in the Employment Equity Act. Late last year, the Trade Union Solidarity submitted to Parliament a petition proposing a legislative amendment broadening the definition of a designated group to include the so-called free-born South Africans. The FF Plus responded to this petition by submitting the legislative proposal under discussion. We are of the view that given the temporary nature of affirmative action measures, this proposal creates the opportunity for affirmative action to gradually phase out as South Africa evolves into a non-discriminating society. In a sense, the proposal is not for a sunset clause for affirmative action, but rather a sunrise clause for non-racialism in the workplace. In addition to this, and then what follows then is obviously the proposal that we have actually made, which is actually just an amendment of the definition clause in the Act. The definition for designated groups being amended, suggested to be amended, to also include the so-called free-born South Africans, and then we suggested the insertion of a definition for free-born South Africans to mean all South Africans regardless of race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, ethnic or social origin, color, sexual orientation, etc., who reached their compulsory school-going age on or after 27 April 1994. The purpose of this amendment, proposed amendment, is to create a situation where all South Africans who actually went to school or who reached the age of school, the school-going age, after Freedom Day 1994, that they are being regarded as so-called free-born South Africans, and in that regard, being allowed to participate freely in the marketplace with regard to jobs, etc. Interestingly enough, last year, or very recently, the ANC president, the elected ANC president, attended a meeting of the Trade Union Solidarity, where actually referred to the proposal, or a proposal similar to this one, as refreshing. And we hope that this committee would find it the same, and that it could open up a debate which could lead, as I said, not to a sunset clause for affirmative action, because no one of us wants the reintroduction of discrimination, but rather, as I said, a sunrise clause for equality. We believe that South Africa needs it. We think the time is right, and we thank you for the opportunity to put this case to you.
Thank you, Mr. Kansarini. Are there any questions from the audience? Just put a clarity on the second number page of the submission. In the first paragraph, says that the Labour Committee, the point of the fact is talking about the failure to make the Labour in Parliament.
That's correct, yes.
And published in its report a proposal.
I can make it available. Yes.
I think we'll discuss that when we get to the point of asking for availability or not. anything you want to add at this stage?
No, I would rather listen to the submission of the department. Apart, perhaps I should add at this stage, I heard along the lines that a similar previous proposal was not addressed because of an argument that was put to the committee that any amendment to a labour law needs to go a certain route through NEDLAC, etc. I've investigated that and I'm very much interested in listening to the different opinions about this, but I've read the Constitution once again with regard to the introduction of national legislation, and from how I understood the Constitution, there's only one process for the introduction of legislation, and that is through Parliament. The Constitution does provide for the introduction of legislation by the relevant minister, being the executive authority. And I can fully agree that the minister could, and that even a law of Parliament could provide for the minister only to introduce a certain piece of legislation after going through certain procedures that have been prescribed in another law of Parliament. But as far as I'm concerned, and that's how I understand the law, that does not take away the original legislative competency of Parliament. I think Parliament still has an original legislative competence in terms of the Constitution that can never be delegated to NEDLAC or to whichever body outside of Parliament. Parliament has got an original power in terms of the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't contain any limitation in this regard, except in one aspect. The Constitution has got a limitation with regard to so-called money bill. A money bill can only be introduced by the Minister of Finance. But for any other, the wording of the Constitution is very, very clear. Any piece of legislation can be introduced in Parliament, and Parliament can decide on that. If the department at any stage wishes to consult with NEDLAC or so, I believe that would be possible. But I couldn't find anything in the Constitution supporting the specific argument that I heard that was put.
Can I clarify just my NEDLAC way was mentioned, but I don't want to speak about the committee, but I was never under the impression that the decision of this committee has to be liability or the other similar proposal has anything to do with that.
Yeah, is it okay then? I had a very second then.
I should also assure the member that if, whatever the case may be, because I think I specifically asked, would that mean, I didn't know how to ask, and I'm not going to that. Would that mean that if we should decide this to be desirable, then people have to go to NEDLAC before people are fellow committed? But that's got nothing to do with our decision as to desirability or the report of the contract.
I think it's a question.
I don't know, I'm just bringing out my personal thoughts on this report. My understanding is arising from this report from my colleague here, Mr. Speaker, that the affirmative action is not fully applied as it should be. And if that is the feeling of this report, then Chairperson, we need to go into deeper and say, why are affirmative action has a rider of discrimination? Because black students and white students is actually mentioned. So we need to seriously look into as to the affirmative action is applied properly as it should be, or where are the flaws of the affirmative. We need to go into these areas to see whether there is a flaw on it or not.
or what are the reasons of having the structure of God being present to the world? Thank you.
Thank you, all right.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. President, members of the committee. I would not restate what Mr. Abel said very in regard to the proposed amendment, very short and very clear. But just dealing with the issue of NEDLAC, what we had raised, for example, in the last committee meeting was that there is a role for NEDLAC in dealing with labor legislation. And NEDLAC, of course, has been established by a statute of Parliament. And one of its responsibilities is set out in Section 5 of the NEDLAC Act, Act 35 of 1994, where in Section 5.1c it says that the Council shall, and this is the objects, powers and functions of the Council of NEDLAC, the Council shall consider all proposed labor legislation relating to labor market policy before it is introduced in Parliament. That is what the NEDLAC Act says. And then, of course, as you had correctly indicated, also that the Minister of Labor is then also the one to introduce labor legislation in Parliament. So amendments to labor legislation should also be considered by government, and specifically the Minister of Labor, as well as the Commission for Employment Equity, with regard to any amendment to the Employment Equity Act 1998 prior to it being submitted to Parliament. And the latter part is set out very clearly as a responsibility of the Commission for Employment Equity Act in giving advice to the Minister of Labour on any matter or any amendment concerning the Employment Equity Act. So that's the first part. The second part is, you've also referred to the Constitution. Now, Section 9.2 of the Constitution states that, and I quote, "Equality includes the full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms. To promote the achievement of equality, legislative and other measures designed to protect or advance persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may be taken," close quote. The Employment Equity Act, therefore, was enacted as enabling legislation to give effect to that clause of the Constitution. And the purpose of the Act is to achieve equity in the workplace by promoting equal opportunity and fair treatment in employment through the elimination of unfair discrimination and implementing affirmative action measures to redress the disadvantages in employment experienced by designated groups to ensure their equitable representation in the workplace. We close quote. Now, Section 28 of the Employment Equity Act established the Commission for Employment Equity, and according to Section 29 of that Act, the Commission consists of a chairperson appointed by the Minister and 8 members nominated by NEDLAC, that is 2 representatives from the state, 2 from organized business, 2 from organized labor, and 2 from community organizations. The key functions of the Commission, as outlined by Section 30 of the Act, are primarily to advise the Minister on codes of good practice in line with Section 54 of the Act, regulations in line with Section 55 of the Act, policy, or any other matter concerning the implementation of the Act. Section 42 of the Act outlines the factors that need to be taken into account when assessing an employer's substantive compliance with the Employment Equity Act, including, amongst others, the following: demographic profile of the national and regional economically active population, pool of suitably qualified people from designated groups from which the employer may reasonably be expected to promote or appoint employees, the number of present and planned vacancies that exist in the various categories and levels,
and the employer's labor turnover and reasonable efforts made by a designated employer to implement its employment equity plan, etc. Now, dealing with the proposed amendments, the first one is a proposal that the definition of designated groups be changed from meaning black people, women, and people with disabilities to meaning black people, women, people with disabilities, and free-born South Africans. The proposal is that the free-born South African means all persons who reach their compulsory school-going age on or after 27 April 1994. The proposal also attempts to amend Section 1 of the Act by adding an additional definition after the definition of family responsibility in the Act. Now, our position is that the Constitution is clear that to promote the achievement of equality, legislative and other measures designed to protect or advance persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may be taken. Now, firstly, free-born South Africans who reach their compulsory school-going age on or after 27 April 1994 would not fall in the category of persons that have been disadvantaged by apartheid in any way, whether directly or indirectly. And here it could be that we're talking of whites here, the free-born South Africans. Secondly, the Act proposes positive action for those groups, that is the designated groups, where the disparity gap is significantly high, which needs to be addressed. Therefore, the focus is on the end result, which is to achieve an equitable and diverse workforce. There are no absolute barriers to free-born South Africans to enter the workforce. Even with them entering the labor market, the means will justify the end results. If free-born South Africans from 1994 onwards that become part of the workforce are mostly white, the end result will never be achieved and the status quo in terms of the huge disparities will remain. So as far as we are concerned, there is no barrier to free-born, so-called free-born South Africans to enter the workforce. Then there was a reference in the motivation of the proposal that, and I quote, it is ideal that as South Africans, that as the South African democracy develops, the benefits of affirmative action measures should be made available to an increasing number of South Africans until someday in the future we reach the stage where all South Africans are truly equal. Now, this, if one takes the objective of the Employment Equity Act, it is already implied in the Employment Equity Act that when reasonable representation of any of the designated groups is achieved in terms of the economically active population, there would be no obligation placed on the employer to continue implementing affirmative action for that particular group. So the end objective of the Act is that we achieve equity in the workplace where reasonable representation of all the designated groups have been achieved. Then, of course, there's no more need to implement affirmative action because you would have achieved the overall objective of the Act. And based on that, Chairperson, the Department of Labor is opposed to this bill by adding a category called free-born South Africans to the designated groups as they are there already. Because the purpose of the Act was very clearly stated, and that is to promote equal opportunity and fair treatment in employment through the elimination of unfair discrimination and implementing affirmative action measures to redress the disadvantages in employment experienced by designated groups to ensure the equitable representation in the workplace. And certainly what is referred to as free-born South Africans doesn't fall within such a category. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
too, that the Constitution places an obligation on the state only to help those people who have been disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. So the flip side of your argument is by saying that the so-called freeborn South Africans were not discriminated against. In the past, and for that reason, are not entitled to help. Likewise, you could argue the opposite side, that people older than a certain stage were the only ones who were discriminated against. The pre-born South Africans did enjoy the benefits of a pre-South Africa, and for that very reason, it might be unconstitutional to have them sharing in differential treatment of some kind. So that's actually the flip side of your argument, that they also need to be considered. We need to find a way to work through that.
A couple of brief comments on the emotional statement. I see both parts of the getting talent and stuff talking about ball. Just for the public. I want to only say that because it's sentimental or it's state that everybody is specific to
to make life try to be submitted to Parliament. I just wonder, I mean, I understand what it said, but technically, I wonder if it would take away a lot of powers from the individual. And by when you submit it, and if you talk about proposed amendments, or it's the second thing, which I just thought I wanted to mention it, thing about Public Order Act, which that was the sort of argument that we've got legal opinions and those opinions to apply.
This like act made by provision for the minister of the party to call a private legislation to go to the next. You are members of Parliament. You are the legislators of the country. And you make provision for these things. So that's what I said earlier, dealing with the government, nothing to do with our decision to do with the party.
Well, it's simple.
The first thing the Freedom Front will do when it takes power is to abolish that.
That's a long time. The sun will first have to set and then rise again. But Jefferson, I mean, that act was passed in Parliament. The NEDLAC Act was passed in Parliament. And there was a specific reason why there was such legislation. Because the constituents in NEDLAC represent quite a large proportion of key stakeholders in this country. So it's the same legislature that passed it. I mean, the constitutionality of every provision of all our laws are checked by the state law advisors and before it's introduced in Parliament. So, but typically.
Which has as one of its main purposes to protect the right to strike in accordance with the Constitution. And there's obviously no problem with that, that right. We uphold it from our party's perspective, and as an individual proposing this proposal, we would support that very strongly. However, I do believe that the current provisions in that Act do not meet one aspect of what has happened in the past could happen in the future. And that is that I submit that at present the Labour Relations Act does not provide sufficient protection to members of the public, private or public institutions in instances where activities of members of trade unions or federations of trade unions are in such a way related to the contemplation and furtherance of or participation in a strike directly causes damage to or loss of property. Now what I'm trying to say there is that in an instance where a trade union or trade union federation or a body has the right to strike and the members go out and strike and cause damage to either private property or public institutions as has happened in the past, the proposal is to hold those trade unions or trade union federations liable for that damage that is caused. There's no financial implication to the that comes with the proposal. The proposal itself is made up of two aspects, two proposed amendments to the Labour Relations Act of 1995, Act 66 of 95. The first amendment to the Act is a proposal that Section 67 under Chapter 4 be amended by the insertion of the following after subsection 9 of the Act, and that would read 10, a union and or a federation of trade unions may jointly and severally be held civilly liable for any damage or loss that may be incurred by a member of the public or by private or public bodies, where the damage or loss results directly from the activities of a member or members of that union and or federation of trade unions in the participation, contemplation or furtherance of a protected strike supported the union and or federation of trade unions was formerly a party to. That would be the first amendment that I'm proposing. The second is that under Section 68, under Chapter 4, we have an amendment by the insertion, and I apologize as I'm reading for the spelling errors here. I'm afraid I haven't done my homework properly. I should have checked this 2 years old, and I should have read it, but if you'll forgive me, insertion should be the word of the following after subsection 5. It would be a subsection 6. It would read as follows. A union and or a federation of trade unions may jointly and severally be held civilly liable for any damage or loss that may be incurred by a member of the public or by private or public bodies where the damage or loss results directly from the activities of a member or members of that union and or federation of trade unions in the participation, contemplation or furtherance of an unprotected strike supported the union and or federation of trade unions was formerly a party to. Now again, what that intends to do is to hold the union or federation of trade unions responsible for damage caused. Chairperson, I think it's clear as it is. There it is. Thank you very much. If you have any questions or issues of clarity, I'd be happy to try and assist you.
Chair, if I may, just a question to the Labour Relations Act clearly exclude such liability? And if not, would there not be a common law action and remedy available in any case for any person that suffered from such damages?
Chip.
If indeed the case, I've read through this, I don't understand what you're doing. My question would be the inclusion of such a thing, I think, is not entitled to have such a thing in a body of law rather than relying on the common law. But it would only be of good advantage if it could ease the burden of proof on the claimant in such a matter, not if it just restates something that indicates a common law remedy in terms of thinking and
thank you. Chairperson, through you, as I understand it at the moment, common law, neither the common law nor existing Labour Relations Act make provision for holding persons or a person liable for any damage that's caused, and that has been the problem in the past. There's nothing that specifically includes it, but I'm not a lawyer, but there's no specific relief under the common law, and that has been the problem when such instances have occurred in the past, which is the reason why I put this proposal to your committee. Because we need to specifically make provision for holding somebody or somebody's accountable. And it would appear to me that the correct person in each instance would be the trade union or federation of trade unions responsible for, who would be responsible for their members. What I'm saying is I understand the common law does not provide relief to ordinary members of the public or public institutions or owners of private property.
Well, the common law probably common law doesn't I'm a big supporter of unions, I can say, from the old non-strike of 27. I don't know, I think it's part of that. If our idea is to build and draft something to include in our labour legislation to assert combined accountability by federation and by union, in that way it needs to be able to claim.
Chairperson, may I respond? As I said earlier, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm trying to deal with this from a common sense or practical position at the moment. This proposal arises from two instances that occurred specifically. One was in Durban, where there was a trade union strike action around the Durban City Hall, and quite substantial damage was caused to city property and to private property. And at that stage, persons who incurred damages were unable to claim. They were not insured, they weren't covered. I'm not even sure if they were insured, if that was covered in terms of their policies. The second action was an action in Cape Town about 2 years ago, where similar damage was caused quite extensively to private property. Now, I don't know what the legal situation was with regard to common law or civil claims or what have you, but the number of businesses and individuals who incurred damage to their property or businesses, again, were unable to claim. And my intention is to provide a specific amendment to the existing Labour Relations Act to make those bodies specifically responsible in those sort of instances.
For me to prove that the union should pay my damages in the case of some person, I need to prove that that person was under control of that union at the time of the strike, that was held by act, supervision, and all of these various of things that needed to be common, which is often impossible to do. Now, because of the fact that you can't prove that, it means that you can't defeat the claim to injunction. But from the other hand, the bad part of that is that unions, and particularly stop shoes and people, supposed to supervise, they just don't care. And I remember, in particular after there was a private security industry strike, of course, all the damage in Cape Town. After the people were thrown on trains, the Easter and Sunstrike, before, after quite some damage. And I remember the way we as members of Parliament talked about it in all committees, cross party line, that there needs to be some way that the unions must accept responsibility when they organize a strike, they should be held accountable for the actions of those strikes. And that is what you need, that is what you need to do if we should decide this is our law, is to word it in such a way, as I said, that you take away that, you take away the proof that specific things and make them, and you know, in other countries, in the modern world or in other parts of the world, where you, if a factory manufactures something, even if you can't prove the incident on its side, they are liable to do that. That is the type of thing that I'm trying to find out. That's what you're talking about. Not necessarily cultural subject,
yeah, I believe I am.
Coming out of the back 40 years of the trade union, you know, it is hard to prove that I caused the damage and I'm a member of the trade union. Because in my experience, well, let me tell you here, and, I have caused a lot of trouble in favor of workers. For the match. But you will find that if you got your union members going on a strike, they'll be completely organized, and there's the police and all these states and all that will be notified to say that we are going on strike. But then you have the public participation.
they aren't on the road, you find there are unemployed people, there are people that do nothing, will join into the truck. And the problem arises there. How do you control that situation? And if one has to say that we have to legislate that, proposal that we blame the union or whoever is striking. They will say factory is striking because of clothing, textile, and everything. And then we have some other union that come in, or the street people that come and join. And they're very anxious, you know, they find it very exciting. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy. So one has to look at all nooks and corners and everywhere to see how do we legislate to put the blame on the union to say, you were not on strike and such damage was done to various properties or whatever. So we need to very carefully look at this before we move into any discussion of this.
Okay. Now, that's a big problem. But also bear in mind, I mean, all these things will turn into court. And the biggest problem with proper justice is the burden of them. Who carries the burden of them? Now, I'm quite sure you will not try to argue that unions are without blame. I mean, what we saw with crowd security is we got clear. Well, members of that strike and of course that. Well, I know about these people that fought into the strike to start breaking the union as well. Now, a big problem at the moment, first of all, the shopkeeper. Well, you yourself, with your car parked out of Parliament, you get there. You have to prove who caused this damage. Then you have to prove it was part of the strike. Then you have to prove various other things in terms of the provision, in terms of the activities of the strike, before you can even start to point the finger at the union. So that enormous burden of proof is on you as an individual, and you are at a disadvantage. If you place that burden of proof to some extent on the union, there will still be contact, there won't be immediately accountable. But at least then you take that burden of proof that the individual shopkeeper in your home base doesn't have the money, doesn't have the means to take to court. The whole shop has been burned down. Then you take that little book, you place it on an entity who organized the thing which, even by the remotest in Iraq, resulted in your damage. And of course, all they need to do is they need to say, well, we can prove that this was the way. Here's video of our march. There's a steward. There's a block walking in the middle of the street. There's some other people running around from the pavements and doing this. Here's our people. For various elements. That's all about the venom. We're not saying you're innocent now, we will now write into law blame to you. What we are saying is, in one way or the other, you will not actually be responsible for this because that is the truth. So it's going to be a difficult thing to prevent. But what you know is, you say, the venom is good for you. You must be innocent instead of the shopkeeper next to your house. I have to prove that somebody can give me something when I'm shopping going down in my family. But that's about fairness. If you want to participate in industrial action, then that comes. You see, that's the other problem very much, very often. We talk about the rights, but we don't talk about responsibility. We say we want the rights to do this, we must accept the responsibility that within all our means, we will ensure that it takes place in an orderly fashion. And if the union in the other case is able to prove that what took place was outside the parameters of the way they actually ensured that the thing went in a controlled fashion, it's fine. They won't be liable. That's not the type of thing you need to think of. It's not saying that you're one way or the other. It's looking at how do we deal with that as a result of what happened often later. And I am of the opinion that in the past, the strikes were a lot more disciplined and important.
So that's the problem. We're turning into cause of anarchy in this country with crime and various other things. This is the thing that we need to just in for a start. Maybe we need to send somebody in some. Now I'm arguing with those guys that I think we need to do here. So I'll keep that.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's just, one is called into a very commonly said captive trinity situation. I'm walking on the street, I'm anxious now, all the excitement. Something gets into my head and I pause. And I get away. I do something and I get away. How can you blame the enemy?
I'll go directly to the response. I think it's the law has indicated very clearly what we meant to seek to do. But we make the same point again about network. The principle of freedom of association as articulated by the ILO is that there should be no special sanctions in respect of conduct associated with strike. Strike should not be targeted. There should be no sanctions other than those that exist in respect of other forms of collective activity, such as public protests and marches. In other words, there should not be one set of rules for trade unions and another for other bodies that call protests and marches. The principle of freedom of association, as articulated by the ILO, calls for proportionate sanctions for unlawful conduct. The sanctions could not be such as to lead to the dissolution of a trade union. A strict liability regime would have the effect of making the unions liable for all unlawful conduct, even in circumstances when they have done all that is reasonable to prevent such conduct. The chilling effect of such a liability regime would trench on both South Africa's public international law obligations and the constitutional rights to protest and strike. And I should just indicate here that this Parliament has also ratified Convention 87, which deals with freedom of association of the ILO, and of which we have been a member since 1994, or readmitted as a member in 1994. This shows that the courts have placed liability on trade unions when their members have engaged in unlawful conduct during strike. In instances where there was a manifestation of criminal activity and or unlawful conduct as required by the constitutional imperative to protect property and lives, the South African police services had acted where criminal activities were perpetrated under the disguise of industrial action. It is evident from the amendment that perhaps, Mr. Lowe, you do not understand the existing law, because whether protected or unprotected, the immunity provided in Section 67 does not extend to criminal activity. Subsection 8 states, the provisions of subsections 2 and 6 do not apply to any act in contemplation or in furtherance of a strike or a lockout if that act is an offense. Close quote. Now, the jurisprudence also indicates that where trade unions have failed to comply with a court interdict on the unlawful conduct of their members, the employer party has approached the courts to seek relief. And in the case of security services, employers' organization, and others versus the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union and others, 2007-28-ILJ-1134, in the Labour Court, the court ordered the trade union to pay the amount of 500,000 rand for contempt of the terms of the court order. Furthermore, the court sentenced to imprisonment union officials for a period of 6 months. Both sentences were suspended for 5 years, provided that the trade unions were not found guilty of the same offense. Now, moreover, the court held other common law jurisdictions held trade unions liable for the unlawful conduct of their members in collective action, as is borne out by the case. Although there has been unlawful conduct associated with the Blackton protests in the last few years, no one has sued trade unions for that conduct. And until our common law has been shown one thing in this respect, it is unnecessary, in our view, to have an amendment that imposes this strict liability, which would be in conflict with the with our international law obligations as set out in the Principle of Freedom of Association Convention of the ILO. And the department is therefore opposed to the proposed amendment to the regulation.
May I respond, Chairperson? Thank you. I just wanted to say, firstly, perhaps I could ask you, Chairperson, a point of clarification from Mr. Kettledust. Are you saying that, for example, in the case in Cape Town where the security industry was on strike or had a march in the centre of the city, and individuals, whether they had damage to motor vehicles, motorbikes, shop windows, whatever, that their only recourse to, if they were not covered by insurance or they were out of pocket, would be to sue the trade union? They would have to institute legal action of themselves. Is that what you're saying, that it's covered in terms of the common law?
Anybody can institute legal action against anybody if they believe that they have a case.
Okay. That's
the other side of the case to answer. But we are saying that in terms of the principle of freedom of association, you cannot have one set of rules that apply to trade unions, but that set of rules doesn't apply to other public protests and marches. I mean, we're a democratic country. We have socio-economic protest action from all kinds of sectors of civil society. And in this proposal, you would basically be targeting the trade unions, which, again, in terms of the freedom of association principles of the ILO, would be in conflict with the international standard concerning freedom of association.
Chairperson, if I could then respond to say this, while I understand that and it makes a lot of sense in law, it seems to me, and forgive my pun, it strikes me as manifestly unfair that where damage is caused to individual, private or public property, it appears that there is no concurrent responsibility that goes with all those rights which are entrenched in our Constitution and in the International Labour Organization, etc., etc. I quite agree that there are rights there. We want to uphold those rights. But the fact of the matter is that there are unfairly no responsibility, and innocent individuals, public bodies, private bodies, are then forced to take action in law, many of whom cannot afford to do so, as we saw. And the reality is that they are out of pocket by a body that purports to have all these rights, but doesn't have the responsibility sometimes to discipline their members or behave properly or whatever. And I would still submit that that needs to be addressed in some way. You can't just walk away from it because there's no concurrent responsibility going with that right.
I'm just not sure what I'm talking about, because I don't see any difference, the burden on the business owner. If I, as an individual, break a window, the business owner has got two options. Either the police sees me doing it, they arrest me.
Or
the business owner sues me for the damage that I've incurred. The same thing applies here. The law is clear. The indemnity, if this action is unlawful, goes away. Therefore, the shop owner who has incurred damage has got an option. Call the police. If the police are in, then they arrest the person that has broken the window. Or use common law provisions that are there. So,
the problem is the proof of the causal link. Between the perpetrator and the union. That's the problem. But it's a problem for the individual one, too. He has to prove that. The responsibility would be on the union to
Isn't that the democracy that we mean? If you take me to court.
Well, when we talk about democracy, we talk about rights and responsibility. And we clearly have this balance. And I'm not arguing you. The problem is, it's not just about damage caused by trust. The overall problem that we found nowadays that if a government department or a big corporate causes damage to you, they can just outstay you in court because financially they're able to do so. And that's the unfortunate thing. So where must we seek to balance it? Where must we seek to attach responsibility to rights in such a way that it's all these people to be disciplined and to oblige those. See, the problem at this stage, the only real way you can alter union libel would be if you can prove that they intend providing for the peace. In other words, engage the peace and do that. Otherwise, it's almost impossible. But yeah, that is the question. That's what we'll talk about.
Yeah.
Sorry, every now and then a little bit of email. It should be.
You know, that's what this is looking for. I mean, we don't want to. I think the committee will interrogate this matter, this is going to work on. And I think maybe we should close it off. This is part two. I'd like to thank everybody for being here, for your patience, for squeezing and drinking the ink. Several of us, your officials, for coming down from the Johannesburg, thank you very much for that. So on behalf of the committee, thanks for your patience, thanks for the catching, please take the journey home, it's been a peaceful discussion, thank you very much, we see you at Thursday. Same time, thank you.
Not Thursday.